Can I just read, brethren, a few verses from 2 Peter? And at chapter 1 and verse 4, Peter says, through these he has given us this very great and precious promises, so that through them you may participate in the divine nature and escape the corruption in the world caused by evil desires. For this very reason, make every effort to add to your faith goodness, and to goodness knowledge, and to knowledge self-control, and to self-control perseverance, and to perseverance godliness, and to godliness brotherly kindness, and to brotherly kindness love. For if you possess these qualities in increasing measure, they will keep you from being ineffective and unproductive in the knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. But if anyone does not have them, he is short-sighted and blind, and he is forgotten that he has been cleansed from his past sins. Now, what Peter is doing there, of course, is he's reminding us about the precious promises of the gospel. And he tells us it is through these promises that we will be able to partake of the divine nature and escape the corruption that is in this world. And it's for that reason, he says, therefore for this reason, he says, I want you to do something. And I want you to make every effort to add certain graces and disciplines to your faith. And the one that we have in view together this afternoon is self-control. Now, you notice at the end of that he mentions love, and we want to come back to that later on. And Peter gives us this wonderful promise. He says, if we increasingly possess these things, he tells us it will mean that we won't be unproductive or ineffectual, and we believe that is in the ministry. And it reminds us, of course, also that if we don't exercise self-discipline, self-control, we are short-sighted. And what we are doing is we are courting failure, and it will lead in our spiritual life to be ineffective. So all the talks and lectures we've had so far this week, they've been about subjects. Whenever you come to speak about something that is personal, we all, I'm sure, shy away from it because perhaps something of ourselves is going to be in it. And I'm sure when the topics were given out, the folk felt that I needed this particular talk more than anyone else. And even if the brethren could not recognise that, I'm sure God knows it very much indeed. When I was thinking about this, it would have been possible, wouldn't it, to go to the great masters in this subject, to look at Baxter and the Reformed pastor, to look at some of Spurgeon's lectures a little further on, someone like Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones and John Stott, and even some of the helpful articles that we've seen, perhaps especially from the principal. And I was wondering, was there a book I could recommend or something even more up to date? And I asked around, and I've read most of this, but I'm sure I can recommend it. It's about a year old. It's on Being a Pastor by Derek Prime and Alistair Begg. And we look at the issues of being a pastor, some of them in self-discipline. And then what they do, they speak about the theory, and then they give their own comments, what they've actually experienced in their own ministry. One of the persons that we always think of when we think of self-discipline, of course, is the life and ministry of McShane. And I just happened to mention it briefly to David Robertson, and yes, you're right, he thought that we could bring his book here. So I want to mention this book, and perhaps David will say something more in the context of McShane and his self-discipline. I think it's always good for us, whenever we come to these subjects, to remember Francis Bacon's great dictum when he said that men need to be reminded more often than they need to be taught. And I'm sure I'm going to be looking at sometimes suspects that are very familiar when we think of self-discipline. I was also encouraged last week that in our Glasgow meeting, or the South meeting for strategy for the way ahead for the church, that it was interesting time and time again, including at the end, what was the things we needed in our lives, ministers, members, and as churches. And what happened was that there was a great need for a closer walk or a more spiritual awareness in our own lives. I want to underline just four disciplines, and I'm speaking mostly from my own personal experience. And when I go through there, I'm speaking usually as a failure. I think the first thing that we need to remind, the first discipline will be this, is the acceptance of two great facts. And I believe we need to return to these constantly in our ministry. And especially this first truth, it is the only way that we will ever have self-discipline. And the first fact we need to remind ourselves is this: we have to remember our calling. We are ambassadors for Christ, and we'll come back to that word, ambassador. Dr. Packer does us a great favour in his introduction to Baxter's Reformed Pastor, because he tells us that when it was being printed, Baxter insisted in that the words "reformed" would be in bold letters. And I used to think what he was getting at was he wanted to make sure this book was Calvinistic, and I'm sure it was. But he was using the reformed word as the same as a renewed ministry. A renewed minister in zeal and faith and in love. And he tells us that in his own day, and I'm sure it's true now, that churches, generally speaking, rise and fall in the proportion to the character and to the spirituality of their ministers. We need self-discipline to make sure that we know that the honour of our Lord rests upon us as a community, perhaps more than in any other group. We know that it is so easy for us to let the world blaspheme the name of Christ. There is always a dread that someone would say, there goes a lazy minister, or there goes a worldly minister. There goes someone who condemns us with his sermon and condemns himself with his lifestyle. When you read books about self-discipline, they really underscore what Kenny was saying earlier. And that is, if we know that we are dealing with men and women and boys and girls who are lost, and if we believe that they are going to a lost eternity, that great truth, if we are worth our salt, will help us to lay ourselves unstintingly out in their service and for the good of their conversion. In other words, we need self-discipline to come back time and time again and ask, what is my prime task as a minister? And if we undermine our credibility, then we know that other folk will say, well, why should anyone else bother if the minister is not characterised with self-discipline? Dr. Johnson once said that if a man knows he's going to be hanged, it concentrates the mind wonderfully. And we need self-discipline so that we would always, as much as possible, ask the Lord to give us an atmosphere that we live in eternity. Because if we don't feel that truth, How can we speak feelingly to anyone else if we don't know it as a reality in our own life? Now, why do we emphasize that particular truth? Because we believe that truth will impart an overwhelming sense of clarity and proportion to our ministry. What it will do, it will inform us in what really matters and what is really necessary. You know, I think what I'm trying to say is this, that self-discipline will always be a byproduct of a proper view of the privilege of being an ambassador for Christ. That's not to say we're trying to lay the whole weight of a lost world upon a minister's shoulders. It's not saying that God does not use others in building up his kingdom. But what it does tell us is this, that these would be the exception to the rule. By and large, he tells us, he uses his servants. If we were asking this question, what is the meaning of self-discipline? And I think a good way to look at it is to think of church discipline. You know, in church discipline we are told that the words used, you remember, it's to put something, to restore something, or to mend something, or to bring something back to its original condition. And we always emphasize that in church discipline, it's always something positive. It's not a negative, it's to equip someone to engage in the battle with greater success. And what I'm saying is, when we come to ourselves, we are able to look at it in that way, of the same focus. So this is not some punishment, it's not some misery to be got through, but it's to give us grace to do the work of the ministry in a better way. After all, whenever we think of renunciation, all we are renouncing are those things that stand in our way from following Christ. And it's Christ we are committed to. Now, it's good to remind ourselves that this is not an end in itself. You know, worldly discipline turns me off. I think it's cold. I think it's selfish. I think it's focused on self. And we need to remind ourselves that whenever we have self-discipline, it is only so that we are able to serve better. But if we fail here, I think Peter is saying we're going to fail everywhere. Now, we know also, don't we, that much of this particular truth about self-discipline is unseen. It would be better to ask our wives how we're doing in that particular road. But we know that while the work to achieve it is unseen, we know that the fruit of self-discipline is seen in our character, and it's seen in a balanced way we live. Shedd, in his book Sermons to the Spiritual Man, has a wonderful sermon for what it means to have Christian discipline or Christian moderation. And Calvin tells us this. He sums up this first discipline in this way, that a man who never cares for the salvation of others, who neglects his own salvation, will never have a real care over someone else's. You see, we're speaking of something that's a relationship, and this relationship's hidden. Our service is so often visible. But what I'm trying to emphasize is this, that God wants quality of life, we believe, rather than the quantity of service. So the first discipline is we remind ourselves constantly of our calling. And we look at self-discipline as a privilege and not a chore. And then there is this second discipline. And I want just to look at some of the pitfalls that I'm sure we've all experienced and all fallen into. And again, some of these are personal to myself. I think the first pitfall we could take is this, is we have to be careful how we deal with our heroes in the faith, those men and women who are our examples. We believe that God has given them to the church for one great reason, to encourage us, and perhaps to function as a goal towards. But we need always to remind ourselves that they were sinners like ourselves, and despite all their gifts, they would never get off the ground of grace. And what happens often is this, that we need to remind ourselves that these men had great difficulties. I was reading in McShane, when I mentioned to David there, he mentions one time he was in absolute despair. We know that he boasted and once said he was as if he was staked in his parish. He was in agony. And therefore we're in good company there. We need to watch how we read. Not so long ago, we all know that Wesley would have all those early morning prayer sessions, and we strive for that. But if he was up early in the morning, he made it a rule that he made sure he had an early night. And there is always the danger of venerating those, say, whom God has given to inspire us and to use them in a way that the devil comes in. I'm sure you can read a book and you might say after it, you know, I never experienced that. And you might think, well, have I any grace? Have I any ministry gifts at all? And of course, the devil will often make sure that we take to heart the successes and we forget about the difficulties. And these men would say something like this, listen, there's no master key. I once heard Al Martin preach, and he said regarding this that there was no master key, something that we are missing in self-discipline. He said if you had the Apostle Paul over to a communion and you were amazed at his preaching and his power and followed him up to bed and you heard him praying, what would he be praying? He would be saying, oh wretched man that I am. Now, I know that they are giants, and before them we are just like pygmies, but they do minister to us. But we have to remind ourselves that we need self-discipline there so that we read them right. One of the books that I've always found really valuable is Martin Lloyd-Jones' Spiritual Depression. And one of the, now you might think, well I would, but you know, I'm just mentioning that, it's a lot of positive things. But one of the things that he re-emphasizes time and time again is this, that he says we have to know ourselves, know yourselves. One of the temptations surely in a ministry is to try and be something you're not. Remember when I was a student to Angus Morrison's late father, Reverend Malcolm Morrison, took me aside once and he said to me, Alistair, he said, just try and be yourself. And I've been struggling at that for ever since, I suppose. But we know what we mean is God uses you. He uses us as ourselves. That's why I think in Martin Lloyd-Jones' book, Preachers and Preachers, he does us all a great favour in this way, that he tells us that we have to avoid universal set rules. And what happens if you cannot follow them, perhaps you feel that you're a failure. We're all different. And he tells us we have difficult physical diets and we have different spiritual ones. You remember the rhyme? Jack Sprat could eat no fat and his wife could eat no lean. And I think there's a spiritual dimension to that. Some of us are able to pray more in the morning. We must realise what is best for ourselves. And I think the first pitfall is this, be yourself and watch what we read or how we read. And then something else another pitfall is this. I think we've to be self-disciplined in the realm of our moods and our emotions. They can so often govern us. And the trouble with emotions and moods that are far too strong, and they fling in the towel much sooner than our minds do. And the danger is sometimes that we read providence through our feelings and through our emotions, and we forget to go to the cross. And perhaps we need to grow up here more than in any other realm. In Packer's book on holiness, he speaks about the Peter Pan syndrome. And he says, you know, he wanted always just to be a boy. He always just wanted to be fun and to be childish. Another commenter once said that one of the greatest problems in society is extreme emotionalism masquerading in an adult lifestyle. And I think we can be shaped and we can be infected in this way through our feelings. And we have to be what? To be in guard and use self-discipline here in the realm of our feelings. Alec mentioned that earlier when he was speaking about marriage, that feelings are given a greater place and honour. And we have to remind ourselves that we're married to Christ and we serve him despite often the way we feel. Another pitfall is in the realm of opposition. You know, we're all opposed, and I'm sure we would also agree that it's most difficult when it's God's people who are opposing us. And God's people have a unique capacity, don't they, either to sweeten our days or to make them miserable. And the minister can never be popular in that way, because we always refuse to take sides. Because of that, we can be misguided, miscalled, we can be maligned. But sometimes you find that when you need someone most, it is then that they turn away from us. And I think also we lose balance here, that often criticism comes, I know it comes rightly, but perhaps it comes from just a few folk. And that seems to colour our day or colour our whole ministry. And we have to be self-disciplined to say, well, there's a lot of other things that are going well and good. It is I suppose, when we look at something, is it half full or is it half empty? I heard a funny story about that I suppose we can remember for ourselves. It was a true story about a man called Danny Smith. He went into a bank in Ottawa in Canada, and he was really hard up and he felt he didn't have enough in life. And he went in with this family gun that was in the house, and he held up the teller, and as he was going out to the bank, the police came and he was arrested. But the police were intrigued after that, because they recognised that the gun that he was using in the hold-up was just a one-off. It was a limited edition. And they found out that the gun was worth $100,000. And so often, perhaps we've got more than what we imagine. And we have to watch when we are thinking of the opposition. It is always true by God's grace that there are more who are with us than that are against us. If we need self-discipline in opposition, we certainly need self-discipline also when we are praised. We've heard about that, so we won't go on about the dangers of pride, of fishing for approval and for our applause. And self-discipline will always tell us this: if they really knew us, they wouldn't be praising us at all. And like Spurgeon said, you're only aware of the stars when you can't see the sun. We are very ordinary, and so we are disciplined in that way whenever we're opposed or wherever we're applauded. Perhaps we could dismiss some of these out and move on to another pitfall, and that is the way that we so easily fail to recognise the things that are really needful, or the one thing needful. Every day there are things that are desirable, but there is often only one thing that must be done. And if we only remembered one thing from this gathering this afternoon, if there was a watchword that we could leave with one another, could we not say it is necessity? You see, if we were sufficient for all things, we could do everything. But life is short, and we are dull, and eternity is close. And it's good in this way, if you think of necessity, and say in different situations, he's my umpire. He's going to decide on the things that need to be done. You see, men are attracted to novelties. We are. And we so often shy away from the great things. Now, I think it was Stott who once said that the great encouragement when we think of the necessities of the ministry is this, that they're few in number and they're shut up in very narrow limits. And he said also something like this, if a necessity is the mother of invention, that necessity will often determine what to avoid and what to engage in. And we're asking ourselves, we need to be disciplined to ask ourselves, well, is this really necessary? Another pitfall, as we know, is indolence, laziness. We confess often, don't we, that we're as lazy as we can afford to be. We all know that ministry is a privilege that none of us keep office hours. And Martin Lloyd-Jones said that even in his own life, as he mentions in Preachers and Preachers, he says, the temptation just to fritter the day away. There is a general slackness in our lives. But I believe also there is this. I think there is a satanic element. We have Kenny saying our enemies are not natural. We know these scriptures, they're evil. And personally, we're fighting for our very lives here. There is this tremendous temptation towards indolence. What about procrastination? My wife tells me that my favourite day is tomorrow. Everything's tomorrow. And sometimes we can be at our desk and you don't feel like doing that. And you say, well, I'll be in a better mood later on, at a more appropriate time. Now that can be true, can't it? We can go back and something can live. But generally it's true that if we don't plan, it won't happen. And there is something else that I have learned, and I'm sure you have yourself, that it's often the things that we are compelled to do that will really be blessed in. The things that we find difficult to do is usually the area that will find great room for growth, because the things that we find difficult are the area, I'm sure, that there is a great blessing in doing these things and not putting them off. What about worldliness? Ministers are worldly like anyone else, and there is always a danger, isn't there, that we can shrink away from things if it's against our interests. We preach regularly against covetousness, but what about ourselves? Remember that incident in Acts? You know, if it was a deadly sin for Simon Magus to try and buy the gift of God for money, it's very solemn if we are selling it short. and forgetting that souls rely on our unworldliness there. And I once heard Finlay Mackenzie saying at Presbytery not so long ago, discussion like this, and perhaps, you know, we've forgotten in our ministry the element of sacrifice. That we forgo things for the sake of the gospel. And then, of course, there's a wilderness unique to the ministry. Jealousy, looking at another man's status. And we need self-discipline to remind ourselves that the Lord gives us, each of us, a work and a ministry to accomplish. Now, none of us are a stranger to these things. But what about this one? Perhaps it's a pitfall we could discuss later on. The tendency we have to blame circumstances. I'm thinking here perhaps about interruptions. Now, because of the open-ended nature of our work, it is right that we are always available for our people. And in each congregation, I'm sure you can instantly think of perhaps many or even one individual that you know really tries you here. I have someone in my congregation, he's called Fergus. Well, she's called Fergus, there's a difficulty there, and I'm not breaking any confidences, but I often think that this individual shall either destroy me or shall elevate me into a saint. In other words, she's certainly good for our sanctification. And when I think of interruptions, again, we could speak about that. How do we deal when we have all of those requests made to us? Now, one of the things is that what we're saying is, let's go back to this arbiter. And perhaps we could say, well, at that time, is this necessary? We cannot do everything, but I believe God in his wisdom always knows we can do what's necessary. A third discipline, quickly. I've headed it here, the assimilation of food, and we've certainly been doing that in the last few days together. Health today is a critical thing. We're told that what we eat and drink is absolutely vital, and we need, we are told, a balance in that way. And often we say to one another, we are what we eat. So since we've left college, I've noticed that some of us have grown. I don't know if it's growing in grace, but we've certainly grown. And perhaps you feel, you know, this week that as you looked at all the speakers, you've said there's too many McDonald's, and perhaps again we could be disciplined there that we've had too many McDonald's in that way. What I'm speaking of here is spiritually, I'm speaking in the spiritual realm. The same truth is saying here, we need a balanced diet. Packery in his book tells us that there is always a balance between truth, experience, and practice. And I'm sure some of us know that he has a diagrams there that were doing the rounds a good number of years ago. We used to see them often. And I don't like these things personally, but I'm going to mention them for this reason. Because if people notice it and they remark on it, you remember the three figures there, these matchstick figures, and the first one we are told is this, here is this man or woman, believer or a minister. You remember, he's got a huge head. And of course it means that this person, he's academic. I'm not speaking against that. It's all head knowledge, and perhaps it become an end in itself. Even John Owen confesses that as an early young minister, he preached and he wrote for distinction. And that's always a danger, that we are known simply for that reason. And then you remember the second figure is this matchstick man, but he's got a huge body. And this person, He cares little for doctrine. What matters is feeling and experience in his all heart. And then there is another picture. This man now, he's got enormous legs and he's an activist and he's restless. And what he puts the emphasis on, it's doing that matters. Now I know that's simplistic, but again there is a balance there, because our folk comment on that if we are either one of these three. One of the things that I found most helpful was a sermon by Sanks that I came across a number of years ago. And it's a sermon on being an ambassador for Christ. And in the sermon he does a very helpful thing. He draws a contrast between the Christian minister and a man called Sir Samuel Hoare, who was later on Lord Templewood. And this man was an ambassador for our country during the Second World War, and he was dispatched to Spain at a very, very critical time. And that man tells us in his book the privileges of being an ambassador. And one of the things he boasts in most of all is access. It was something that was jealously guarded. It was absolutely vital for him that he had access to a sovereign, that he knew his mind. And he tells us in that day it was a sworn undertaking by the post office that the dispatch boxes would always arrive unopened 24 hours every day. And they could say, when my sovereign speaks, I'm going to listen. When I speak to him, he will hear me. And he says nothing external could stop that communication. And he tells us the only thing that stopped it was indifference. Now if we take that into the spiritual realm and we ask ourselves, well, we have access always into the King of Kings. I'm not going to speak about prayer, because there is an utter unworthiness, I'm sure, in most of our lives that we feel here more than anywhere else, although we have the privilege of access. And we have so many books on how to pray and when to pray. And the most difficult thing, as we all know, is to engage in prayer. But perhaps because we find it so difficult, it's a great indication of the importance of prayer in our spiritual battle. And of course, Satan is there as well. I'm sure we've all read of those prayer heroes and warriors and the time they prayed for. And I've never been able to reconcile that. It's always humbled. But Alistair Begg says a helpful thing. He tells us this: if we can't match them for the time they pray, well, can we not try and pray so fervently as they did, even if it's only for 5 or 10 minutes? We know it's easier to study for 5 hours than to give half an hour to prayer. The next part of the sermon always seems more urgent than turning aside to prayer. And yet we know that the impulse to pray produces often our best sermons and our best work. And self-discipline tells us this: it's not a distraction. And don't listen to the evil one. Can't we be professional also, as we're told, reading the Bible? What we mean by that is always trying to get something that applies to someone else. Or perhaps in our public prayers, praying for others in a way we don't really pray fervently for ourselves. This man, Samuel Hoare, tells us this, that he says that's the privileges of being an ambassador. And then he tells us that there are dangers of being an ambassador. And we'll finish with this thought very quickly. He tells us what are the dangers, and he tells us he found that it when he was too long away in a foreign land. He said, the trouble was I often found I did not have enough visits home to breathe my own native air. And he tells us a very interesting thing. He found himself that he got denationalized. And he tells us the horrible thing about this was this. It was so insidious. It was a process. He tells us when he went first out, he tells us he was British through and through. He could have turned round and there was a made in Britain in his back. He tells us he saw everything from his sovereign's point of view. He was absolutely determined that he would speak only and live only to his prime allegiance. But then he tells us he lived with the others. He was very cosmopolitan. And he heard other points of view. And he says the great pressure was upon him was this way. To be loyal to the commission that his sovereign gave him. His prime allegiance. Now could we not think of being despiritualized? That we fail often to come back and to breathe, to read, and to remember our prime allegiance. And he tells us, lastly, this, the great thing that he loved above all that helped him, he tells us, was coming back home to his own people. And that's the fourth discipline, what we've been able to enjoy together this afternoon or these days. It's the importance of fellowship. When we're alone, or perhaps when we voluntarily take up a position of isolation, perhaps it's when we're down, or we're bitter, or we're fed up, we know that it is then that we lose our way. And we need self-discipline, that our Christian brother ministers, their friendship is invaluable there, because when we're our own, I think sometimes we hold too close or too strongly to opinions that really don't matter. And we see it's scriptural that we have close friends, those that we're spiritually closer to. In that book I was recommending, there's an interesting section that the authors say that sometimes in most friendships you find that one is more talented than another brother. And he tells us in that situation, it is a God who brings them together. And fellowship in that way, sometimes it helps us, perhaps, to exercise grace and patience with someone. And perhaps in the other person, it would avoid jealousy in their parts. Professor Collins used to say that every minister should have a soul friend or a soul mate, and I'm sure that's something we all have, and we should remember that in our discipline. I think it's also good, just one more, we all want to be applauded, and there's nothing wrong with that, but the authors remind us there that when that happens, you've got to be disciplined in this way. What you have then is admirers, but perhaps not friends. And admirers often love us for the sake of our talents, but our Christian brethren will love us for ourselves. And true Christian fellowship is always admonishing, it's always encouraging, and faithful are the wounds of a friend. And perhaps you know a phone call, a quick conversation to a fellow minister can mean the difference from a day of defeat turning into a day of victory. Perhaps it helps us to see something from another angle, and we know how precious fellowship is. We're told that as we have fellowship one with another, that in the things essential we have to have unity, in those things that are not essential, liberty, but in all things, love. And the only way we will have self-discipline again, is to remind ourselves that without love, we've got absolutely nothing. Everything must have its source in love. And time again, we need the love of God shed abroad in our hearts. Perhaps in this hall, to remember, we need the power of a new affection. Because love, it pervades everything. You see, a good thought is confined to the understanding. Volition stops at the will. But love, you see, is diffused absolutely everywhere. And it's love that will interpret it, every unexpected disappointment, all the deferrings of hope, all the difficulties, the bitterness, the grudges, the self-pity, all these wasting diseases of the soul. It will help us to persevere in self-discipline. I remember when I was licensed to preach, one of the ministers told us this, never forget this, that God loves you. But sometimes we're conscious, finally, of being humbled. And could I just mention another sermon that I found wonderfully helpful in this way? It was a sermon about the return of Ezra and Nehemiah. And the text was that they began with building the altar. Here they are, they returned from Babylon, everything's in ruins, the temple's destroyed, and they tell us this, where to begin. They begin by building the altar. And that's where we begin. We always have the temple in view, what God is able to work within us. But we begin at that place of sacrifice.